I think we can all agree the current political moment is fraught. But how does it compare to the other fraught political moments in history?
It felt for a time in part of that decade like everything was falling apart. Young people against old people, anti-war violence, peace movement.
I'm former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. And this week, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins me on my podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet. We talk about difficult times in America's history and how its people overcame them. The episode is out now. Search and follow Stay Tuned with Preet wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff, and I am joined belatedly by my co-hosts Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer. Hey, guys.
Hey, we apologize.
Yeah.
I don't apologize for shit.
Well, you should apologize because I was sitting in here waiting to record at the time that we designated and you guys were off playing FIFA 14 as you seem to be at all times.
I stand by the choice.
Our sponsor this week, unsurprisingly, is FIFA 14 by EA Sports. They kindly sent us some video games and have ruined our week with outstanding gameplay and nonstop action. I think we have another sponsor this week. Is that correct?
We do. We are sponsored this week by LearnVest.com. LearnVest is a place where you can get free money tips, tools, and advice to help you make progress on your money.
I need some of that. Our second sponsor, as always, is Tiny Letter from the good people at MailChimp. It's a simple, powerful way to send an email newsletter. We thank them for their sponsorship. Evan, who did you talk to this week?
I talked to John Ronson. John Ronson from The Men Who Stare at Goats, probably his most well-known book, which was turned into a movie with George Clooney and other people. He has also done wonderful This American Life pieces and GQ, and anyone who's British would know him from television as well. He's also hilarious.
Thorn in the side of the cruise ship industry.
Thorn in the side of a lot of people.
He made you so happy. He was so funny. He made you so happy.
So happy. Yeah. But he also does really serious stuff. He's a serious journalist. You think he has not serious subjects sometimes, but he takes it very seriously.
He's not the guy kind of guy who would miss an appointment to play FIFA.
That's exactly right.
Here's John and Evan.
Blind pig, you know, off Union Square. You know, these Americans go, you know, we hate Tottenham. And it's like me, like being in like Russell Square in North London, going, you know, fucking Newark, New Jersey.
Yeah, it's very strange. There's one in Brooklyn too, the Woodwork, the soccer bar here, also is all Arsenal.
Right.
All the Arsenal fans go there.
Right.
They're just playing at it. All the Americans are not really, not really upset about it. But you grew up in Cardiff. That's what I took from following your tweets and reading other things. But one thing I wanted to ask you was, I don't want to have to go through this whole sort of like, what is the basis of your journalistic motivations? But I am interested sort of like, what got you interested in these characters? Because you really specialize in, I don't know how you would describe them, not fringe, because some of them actually turn out to be important
really
to politics.
But well, I mean, the last big person I did actually was Malcolm Gladwell. I did this big half hour discussion with him a couple of days ago, and he's not, you know, obviously he's not fringe. I suppose I'm looking more than fringe. I was going to say I'm looking for sort of absurdity, but that's not right either. Quite often the stories are quite absurd.
Yeah.
I think I'm looking for sort of unexpected, you know, strange narratives that kind of, I don't know, shed a light on the way the world works in a sort of unexpected way. And quite often those things happen on the fringes, and quite often they happen in a sort of a kind of absurd way, but not always. Like with Gladwell, it's something completely different. Gladwell, it's about, well, for me, it was about the film's going out tomorrow night on BBC Two, as I said. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I wanted to do it was because I've always wanted to ask him about broken windows, you know, because he supported the broken windows policy. His essay, The Tipping Point, was all about how, you know, Giuliani and William Brasson were right, you know, and that declaring war on fare dodgers would stop murders. And as a result, and I always had the theory that, you know, that I wasn't really around in New York in the mid-90s. I mean, I visited from time to time. But my theory was that nobody really wanted to hear it from Giuliani because he was such a kind of boorish sort of thug. But when Malcolm Gladwell came along and said it, I was like, oh, okay. So it's like Malcolm Gladwell gave liberals permission to be more conservative.
Mm.
So Anyway, well, and then, you know, a whole generation of people, thousands, tens and thousands of people, you know, were criminalized for basically being misfits. And there's no evidence that broken windows was the thing that was responsible for the decline in major crime. So I always wanted to have that conversation with him. So, and to me, that sort of fits, I guess, what you'd call sort of my formula for the sort of things I want to tell stories about, because, you know, this was itself, I thought, kind of absurd and unexpected, because it was like a intellectual ideas-based article in The New Yorker, mm-hmm. the ripples of which affected tens of thousands of people in the outer boroughs. Mm-hmm. So that kind of, you know, pricked my interest in a way that a more fringy story would, because, you know, do you know what I mean? I thought
yeah.
It's kind of similar.
Yeah, it seems like you're often, you're solving mysteries. I mean, to some extent, any journalist mm-hmm. that's telling stories is solving mysteries. But the Gladwell one seems different than some of the other ones, because I was going to ask you, when you go into some of the things, whether it's The Men Who Start Goats or, you know, you can pick the example, but do you feel like you don't want to know the answer to the mystery and you don't try to go and read about everything about it beforehand?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, the first big story I ever did, I suppose, or one of the first ones, was this thing. It was in my book, Them, and it was about the Bilderberg Group. Like all these conspiracy theorists and neo-Nazis and Islamic militants all shared this one belief that the secret rulers of the world met once a year in a five-star hotel with golfing facilities, and they were called the Bilderberg Group. And one of them said, you know, if you want to find out more, you should get in touch with Big Jim Tucker. So I contacted Big Jim Tucker, who just died about 6 months ago. Mm. Frankly, I'm amazed he lasted that long. I mean, I met him in like 96, and we were gonna infiltrate Bilderberg 3 months later, and I was just thinking to myself, you know, just don't die for the next 3 months, because yeah, he smoked like 80 a day, and emphasis.
Well, you would if you were really concerned with the Bilderberg Group.
Well, plus I had it was a good story. Yeah. I wanted to die. So you said yeah, they meet. And they're not playing pinochle in there. And he said, I've discovered where they're meeting next. They're meeting at this hotel in Portugal, the Sintra Park. What's it called? The Caesar Park Hotel and Golfing Resort, Sintra, Portugal. And he said, I'm going to fly over there, climb up the drain pipes, get in and confront them red-handed going about their covert wickedness. So I said, can I come? And he said, yeah. So I deliberately didn't research Bilderberg, and I didn't research him or the newspaper that he worked for, which was called The Spotlight. Uh-huh. I deliberately didn't do anything. I wanted to be absolutely swept up in the mystery. And I sort of got into trouble a little bit for that one, because it turned out much later I discovered that Jim Tucker's newspaper had kind of neo-Nazi leanings. Mm. They were part of this group called the Liberty Lobby. I got a Holocaust deniers and stuff. And a few people said that I was being kind of, you know, faux naive to have not known that, or to have pretended to have not known it. But I really didn't know it, because I made the kind of conscious decision to not research, because I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to solve the mystery before it had been undertaken. And I've kept that up over the years. I only do stories where I really want to know the answer to something. So Gladwell sort of does fit into that, even though it's sort of an unusual sort of story for me, it does, because I really wanted to know how he feels about that, you know, how he feels about being kind of partly responsible for like tens of thousands of lives being ruined. And also how amazing it is that one article in The New Yorker can have that power. So, you know, there were sort of mysteries in that one. But yeah, the psychopath test starts with a literal mystery, a kind mm-hmm. of mysterious package arriving through the mail. And a lot of my best stories are sort of, and in fact, my new collection, Lost at Sea, the subtitle is The John Ronson Mysteries, because I wanted it to sound I wanted it to sound like kind of Nancy Drew.
That's actually literally I had written down that I imagined you were like some kind of like Hardy Boys kid.
Yeah,
you know the Hardy Boys.
Yeah. I certainly remember the I Spy Club in Cardiff.
Yeah. But how did you I'm interested a little bit in the background of how you got to the place where you could say to the Bilderberg guy, you know, I want to go along with you. Like a little bit about your career and how you got into journalism.
Okay, well, so I went just to the local high school, Cardiff High, and at the age of 16, I was kind of, you know, pretty sort of, you know, awkward, you know, not ambitious, just sort of suburban kid.
In fact, you were at one point thrown into a lake, as I understand.
I was thrown into a lake.
That's a This American Life piece that also appears
In one of my books, Out of the Ordinary. Yeah, it's funny, actually, you mentioned that, because I was thinking about, I haven't thought about that story in years, and I was thinking about it today, because I'm doing This American Life at the moment, and a conversation I had with Ira popped into my head, because what I did was, so I was thrown in the lake when I was 16, Roth Park Lake in Cardiff, and then I woke up in the middle of the night, like a couple of years ago, realizing I was still annoyed about it. And so I've emailed one of them. I went on to Friends Reunited and emailed one of them to say that I'm now a best-selling author. And he emailed me back to say that the reason why they threw me in the lake was because I was a pain in the ass. And the tenor of my email leads him to suspect that I haven't changed. And that throwing me in the lake again today would be inappropriate. So then I got invited to the school reunion. So I thought I should go to the school reunion and take a radio producer with me and talk to the people who'd throw me in the lake. Anyway, I was in the kitchen house, and then I did it for This American Life.
Yeah,
and I remember
it has a great, it's sort of a classic This American Life, because it has this, people should go listen to it, so it's like a spoiler, but it's a few years old, so I think it's fair to
have a spoiler,
but it kind of goes in one direction, and then at the very end it comes back in another direction in an amazing way.
Yeah. My first inkling that This American Life didn't quite see it the way I did was when I realized what they'd called the item. They'd called it Who Takes the Class Out of Class Reunion. And then Ira said to me, this is what I remember this morning, Ira said to me, you know, why? Why did you do it? You know, why? I can't remember what I replied, but I mean, what I thought, you know, the real reason why I did it was because I thought, you know, this is a kind of funny, unexpected story. It can make a funny piece of writing or piece of radio. And but Ira totally couldn't see why somebody would still feel aggrieved, you know, 20 years later, and want to go to the extent of actually taking a producer with him to the reunion. I suppose now I look back on it, I kind of side more with Ira than I do with myself. I wouldn't do it now. I definitely wouldn't do it now. It was actually something, it was like a good story that came from immaturity.
Oh, really?
Huh. Yeah, I think so. I wouldn't do it now. I would have, I'm too mature to do it.
Or now. Maybe you would have done something even fancier to really show that you were successful, because that was the original idea, right? You were going to go back and show that you were successful.
Yeah.
They should have thrown you in the lake, or they should have known.
Yeah. There's this very beautiful TV star called Zoe Ball, who at the time was like a household name in Britain, and I mean, she's still very well known. Anyway, my initial idea was to turn up with her. But it's so kind of, I mean, it is. It's very classless. It was wrong.
But anyway, I stopped you in the middle of you grew up there.
Yeah, I grew up there. And when I was 16, my mother sort of forced me to intern at the local radio station. And I suppose that's what started it. I you know, kind of completely fell in love with it. And this presenter called Binder Singh took me under his wing and sort of put me on the air. And I loved it. And as a result of that, I got accepted into Journalism College in London.
Mm.
And I did 2 years and then flunked out. Because I started playing with a band. I started playing with a band called the Frank Sidebottom Oh Blimey Big Band. And that's come full circle because I've just written a film which is about to come out. This kind of inspired by that time with Michael Fassbender.
When is this film coming out?
Hopefully it'll be out by like January, February next year.
And this, I was reading about it, and I think this is probably a phenomenon that's very well known in the UK, but I was not familiar with it. But the band itself sounds sort of amazing.
Well, Frank Sidebottom wore a big papier-mâché head, a big fake head that he never took off. And so nobody outside his inner circle knew what he looked like underneath the head. Anyway, we decided to fictionalize it. So our Frank, who's Michael Fassbender, never takes the head off, like never, hasn't taken it off since, you know, well, we don't know, since he was like 12. So what we've kind of done is we've combined the real Frank Sidebottom with other outsider artists like Daniel Johnson and Captain Beefheart and the Shags and a few others. And we've created this sort of fictional character that takes from all of these other people. So actually there's a lot of Daniel Johnson in our Frank.
Daniel Johnson.
Yeah. So
is that not a problem that you get an incredibly world famous actor to play a part where he never takes off the head? Wasn't that some studio person who said, but he's got to take off the head. That's why we got him.
It's really funny, actually, because I went on, when he first got cast, I went on the Michael Fassbender fan sites, and that's what they were all saying. They were going, well, I don't know whether we should, I mean, should we see the film now? I didn't know what to think. And it's funny, also on the Fassbender fan sites, it's like when a new still of him comes out, you know, they put it, then discuss it. So here's Michael Fassbender in 12 Years a Slave. Here's Michael, you know, looking very beautiful. And here's Michael Fassbender in our film with like a big fake head and a kind of painted on cartoon face. And they're all sort of not really admitting, you know, that they don't really know what to do with it.
But you played in the band. You were a musician in the band.
Yeah, I was the keyboard player. But that's why I dropped out of journalism school, because, yeah, I mean, what an offer. I mean, at the time, Frank was, you know, playing. We were selling out venues of up to 1,000 people, which to me was like, Jesus, you know. And we went around the country, you know, for months and months and months, just playing at these venues, and it was amazing. We supported Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers, and supported Bros at Wembley. Bros were like our new kids on the block.
You played at Wembley?
Well, actually, I didn't play the Wembley show, but Frank did. I played the Jonathan Richman show.
Oh, yeah.
He was bottled off, Frank, after 10 seconds. he was, well, after about sort of 5 minutes, he was doing Bros cover versions, and everyone was booing, and finally got bottled off stage. So then Frank fired us all for tax reasons. He owed £30,000 back tax, and he stood up in court without the head on, and the judge said, "This is a very serious matter. Have you thought of a payment plan?" And he said, "Would £1 a week suffice, my lord?" And the judge said, "No, it would not." And so he fired us all. So there was my show business career over. And so I went back into journalism.
And did you go, was that radio that you took up at the beginning? Or was it...
No, there was this newspaper called The Sunday Correspondent, which closed down because it went down. This is a shows the sign of the times. It closed down because it started to only sell 250,000 copies. So... Richard Branson took it over for a bit, and it, you know, and it still wasn't selling, and so they closed it down. But I remember my big sort of Damascus. It's kind of really strange Damascus sort of moment. But shortly after I was fired by Frank Sidebottom, I bought the Sunday Correspondent. It was like the first ever issue, and there was this article in it about a professional Andrew Lloyd Webber lookalike, and the article was about how it was like an Icarus story. Like, he was getting so much work, he was beginning to actually think he was Andrew Lloyd Webber. And I just thought this was like the greatest thing I had ever read. I thought it was funny and surprising and very dialogue heavy. It was written by a writer called Luke Jennings. And I read it and I just thought, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And it is what I did for the rest of my life.
Hey, this is Max. I'm one of the co-hosts. And I'm going to pause things just for a second and tell you a little bit about our sponsors. We've got two. The first is EA Sports FIFA 14. That's a soccer video game for the uninitiated. Maybe more accurately, it is the soccer video game. We've been playing nonstop in the office for the last couple of weeks. I've been just decimating Aaron. It's been ugly. And the good folks at EA Sports have given us a couple of games to give away to you, the listeners. So if you send me an email, max@longform.org, put EA Sports FIFA 14 in the subject line, and if you are one of the first five people to email, I will go to the post office and put a game in an envelope, and it will arrive at your house for free. That's a pretty good deal. If you're interested in more good deals, or just generally making a good deal out of all of your financial arrangements, you should check out our second sponsor, LearnVest. LearnVest is pretty simple. They want to help you make good financial decisions, and they've got a pretty innovative approach for how they do that. When you join LearnVest, you get unlimited access to money tips and lessons. They've got this thing called Money Center that allows you to connect all your accounts and set up a budget and track progress against your financial goals. They've got experts you can talk to about retirement and debt and savings, words you have heard but maybe don't totally understand. You're going to get no jargon, just good financial advice. Hundreds of thousands of people are already using LearnVest. you should join them. It's completely free to get started. Just go to learnvest.com/longform. Thanks to them. Thanks to EA. Let's get back to John and Evan.
And how did you sort of develop your, you know, your reporting and writing skills at that time? Did you feel like you sort of came naturally to, I'm a storyteller and I figure out how this is? Or did you feel like that you struggled for a while to figure out what your voice was and how it all worked?
No, honestly, to tell you the truth, it came really easily to me. I mean, that's why I sort of knew. I didn't particularly enjoy it. I mean, I much preferred, you know, it was lonely. And at the time, I wasn't quite as introverted as I am now. You know, at the time, the idea of spending your life, you know, indoors by yourself, you know, was kind of horrific to me. So I kind of learned to love it, but in terms of being good at it, it just came naturally to me. It's the only thing, you know, that I ever did. I had a good ear for dialogue. The first story I did, actually, so I approached the Sunday Correspondent and I said, you know, I'd love to write that kind of thing. And almost immediately I did a story for them, and it was the very first thing I ever had in print, and it was about an insecure comedian called Bob Dillinger. I spent a day with him, and every time I was like 18, and every time he said something funny, he'd say, "Is that funny? Will I use it?" And it was just this kind of, you know, so is that this kind of, you know, The Entertainer, you know, that Laurence Olivier movie. And so that was the first thing I had in print. And yeah, so I had a good ear for the dialogue and for the kind of rounding of a story. And I think in terms of like sort of the way I write, it kind of really hasn't changed in all these 30 odd years. What has changed is that, you know, I certainly won't do a story where the person is left without any, you know, sort of dignity. I think in the early days, I didn't really care. You know, when I was 18, didn't really care how Bob Dillinger felt about it when he read it. And, you know, now I really do care. Now, you know, I make, you know, a very big effort that nobody loses their dignity in my stories. And the other thing that really matters now is that I won't do a story where, you know, there isn't some sort of, I won't do a story that doesn't matter. You know, I want to find those stories, but where, you know, the ripples affect the way society works.
Mm-hmm.
You know, war or power structure or psychiatry and the psychopath test, or, you know.
Did you find in the early, you know, like in some of the stories in Them, that was your second book, I think. Was the second book?
Well, my first sort of proper book. I wrote a sort of, it's kind of stupid. I did a TV series called The Ronson Mission for BBC Two when I was about sort of 22, 23. It was really bad and very unsuccessful. And that was it. I sort of thought that was it for my career. It's like, you know, I'd sort of failed on a big stage. And then the only job offer I had after that was to write a kind of stupid sort of stocking filler type book. So I did. And then I was kind of terrible. And then after that, I wrote Them, which I always called my first book, until it got nominated for the Guardian First Book Award. And then I was like, and then they phoned me up and said, "I believe this isn't your first book."
Oh, no.
And I went, you know, clubbed class. Looks like a book, but I wouldn't call it a book.
What constitutes a book? Really?
Yeah, exactly.
Under the rules.
Yeah.
Anyway, I mean, they need very specific rules, right, about that sort of thing.
I was disqualified.
But those people, I assume you were writing about those people. It's like Alex Jones and, like, you know, conspiracy theory stuff is in there. And then there's like the Tottenham Ayatollah.
Mm-hmm.
And how did those people feel about, did you find that when that stuff came out, people thought that you'd taken them apart, or that they had sort of like, you'd let their voice out into the world?
I think with that book, it was sort of half and half. I think because the first kind of, I think, big proper story I did after that was Tottenham Ayatollah, which was really the story that kind of, I suppose, kind of put me on the map, certainly in Britain.
And ended up later as a This American Life.
Yeah, yeah.
Considerably later.
So it kind of put me on the map here as well, in a way. And that was a story about the rise of Islamic militancy in London, and nobody was paying attention to it at all, to the extent that I remember somebody from a Jewish rights group, sort of Britain's version of the ADL, said to me, you know, nobody has any idea what this means yet, but, you know, people will.
Hmm.
And this was like 97, and, you know, yeah, he was right. I thought at the time, I thought he was kind of being paranoid, and obviously not. So that was a story about kind of this guy called Omar Bakri, who basically declared holy war on Britain. And he said he wouldn't rest until he saw the flag of Islam flying over Downing Street. And we thought, what was interesting about that story was that, you know, he lived among us, so he'd need to kind of use our symbols to destroy us. He'd need to use capitalism to destroy capitalism. So I wanted to try and write about Omar and film Omar in the same way I was doing, like, The Neurotic Comedian or you know, stories like that, but about something that was much more important.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, on the first day with him, he said, you know, I've let you into my life. I would like something in return. And I said, okay. And he said, will you drive me to Office World, where he gets his kind of Islam, the Future of Britain pamphlets done because of their special price promise. That, you know, they'll give you double the money back if you can find a photocopying service that's cheaper. So straight away, that was like the comedy of the story. So we spent a year with him. And then I snuck into Bohemian Grove with Alex Jones, which was like, I guess, and the Bilderberg group. You know, got chased from Portugal with Jim Tucker. They set their security guards onto us. And I got incredibly paranoid and started getting chased by the Bilderberg group's secret security. And I phoned up the British Embassy and said, I'm being chased by the Bilderberg group. And they went, and then they went, go on. They said, what are you doing here? I said, I am essentially a humorous journalist out of my depth. So could you phone up the Bilderberg group and tell them that? So who felt, I think Alex Jones was fine. And in fact, when I wrote The Minister at Goats, he really liked that. A couple of years later, sort of felt that I'd gone more into his camp.
Oh, did he send you a note saying thank you for pursuing this?
Yeah, had me on his show.
Ah.
Had me on a show. Turned out that all of his listeners kind of hated me. I got so much abuse. You know, that none of them had, you know, they saw me as like a shill, you know, for the New World Order.
It is an interesting contrast. Mm-hmm. I hadn't thought about that you were sort of writing about these conspiracy theorists. And then The Minister of Ghosts is really about a thing that you can't imagine it's possibly true that is actually true.
Yeah, absolutely. It's you're right. I mean, conspiracy theorists really like them. Conspiracy theorists hated them because, you know, it was a book that basically said, you know, yeah, Bilderberg Group exists. Yes, Bohemian Grove exists. But they're nothing like the way the conspiracy theorists see them. You know, yes, it's odd and it shows how power works, but... You know, conspiracy theorists add this sort of this level of fiction to it that's, you know, that they do it knowingly and it's dangerous and pernicious. So conspiracy theorists really hate it. It's a rationalist book. But what's really interesting with The Minister at Goats is, yeah, in some ways it sort of feels like a conspiracy theory, but it is one that turned out to be true, that there really was a group of military intelligence people try to walk through walls and become invisible and kill goats just by staring at them.
How quickly did you get far enough into the story that you thought, this is a book and this is incredible? I mean, it seems like one of those stories that you stumble upon and say, you know, again, like, this can't possibly be true. And if it is, this is a book for sure. Or did it evolve over time out of a series of...
No, actually, it was kind of a disaster for a long time. It was one of the most difficult working periods I had, because what happened was Them came out in sort of 2000, 2001, and I did a TV series to go alongside it called Secret Rulers of the World, and it was a big hit. It was the first time I'd ever had, like, a proper hit. And, you know, Them went into the bestseller list, and it did kind of well over here. Although it came out just after 9/11 over here, which wasn't the best time for a sort of funny, nebbishy book about extremism, it turned out. Like, Terry Gross gave me a hard time on Fresh Air. And,
oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, a few people got it. Like, Ira, you know, This American Life got it. And John Hodgman got it. And, you know, Sarah Vowell. So, you know, I had some people who could see that, you know, the 9/11 and people with buffoonish character traits... You know, don't have to. One doesn't have to, you know, make the other one invisible.
There were buffoonish things about the 9/11 hijackers. Even they did ridiculous. Like, no one would look at them as comedic, mm-hmm. given what happened. But the sort of like going to the gym and not, and like, you know, not exercising really. I remember that, some of that stuff in the news, but
completely. But, you know, people didn't want to hear it. I mean, it took a few years before people wanted to, you know, sort of think about that, I think. And, but, so then what happened, it was Channel 4, the TV company I worked for in Britain, said, you know, give us some more secret rulers. And here is, and nobody's ever said this to me before or since, you know, here's like, it was a lot of money. Like, here's like £500,000 to go and make more. And I didn't have like any ideas. And I was like, say, I don't think I can do this. You know, I think this is like a disaster. And there was so much pressure. Like, people said, look, no, this never happens. You know, you never get like a, you know, carte blanche to do whatever you want. You've got to do it. In fact, our very first trip was the weekend before 9/11. And we had all these dead ends. So the first thing we tried to do was something about the Skull and Bones Club, trying to sneak into the Skull and Bones Club. And that, I felt really kind of grubby. Like I was taking this student club seriously. Like I was a grown man going to Yale to try and turn this into a sort of sinister, you know, to take it seriously. It was a stupid student club. So, I mean, I know it's a stupid student club with power, but you can see why that story would make you feel uncomfortable.
Student club with eventual power. It doesn't have any literal power, really. It's sort of like anointing people to later be powerful, maybe.
Yeah. But it was sort of kids, you know. So that one failed. And then I tried to do this story about how George Bush's grandfather, Prescott Bush, had grave robbed Geronimo's grave and stolen his skull, which might actually be true.
Really?
Yeah, but it was impossible. I'd never done a historical story before and I didn't know how to do it. So we wasted a lot of time and money doing that and it came to nothing. And then the third one we tried to do was this Bush's first biographer, James Hatfield, I think his name was, died in mysterious circumstances. And a whole lot of people basically thought that Karl Rove had him killed. And so I tried to do that. And then that was like, it turned out that this guy was, you know, up to his eyes in kind of credit card debt. And, you know, basically, I'm pretty sure he'd killed himself. And Karl Rove had nothing to do with it. And so by then, we'd wasted like about £150,000. And, you know, Channel 4 was getting worried. And I was like saying to everyone, look, I told you, you know, I told you this was going to happen. It's, look at it, look. And I was having like sleepless nights. My baby, I had like a baby at the time, it was like two. It's like 2 years old, and I'd be like waking up in the middle of the night having anxiety attacks and going back and forward to America and, you know, spending all this money, like going back and forward to America and not getting anything, not getting a thing. And with Secret Rulers, every time we turned on the camera, something interesting happened. You know, David Icke, Alex Jones, it was great. And then with this, it was like a disaster. So anyway, so to cap it all, and by the way, I've never, because these are all stories about failure, so I've never really told these stories before.
Uh-huh.
So I should tell you that these aren't rehearsed stories. These are stories I've never told before. So my producer at the time, John Sargent, said, why don't we do remote viewing? And I knew a tiny bit about remote viewing, but it was this idea that the US military had these secret psychic spies that were like sitting in a condemned clapboard building in Fort Meade, Maryland, trying to be psychic. And this writer called Jim Schnabel had just written a book about it called Remote Viewing. And so reluctantly, because I felt like, you know, someone else had already done the story, you know. So reluctantly, I met a couple of these psychic spies, Joe McMonagall and Ed Dames and one or two others. And the stories were kind of okay, but kind of boring. I mean, you know, basically, if you spend 20 years, like, it sounds like if you're a secret psychic spy working in black ops for the US military, that sounds really exciting. But in real life, it's basically just sitting in a room for 25 years trying to be psychic. And then every so often your funding gets, you know, you know, like a new rationalism sweeps into the, you know, the CIA, and they don't want to fund you anymore. But it's, you know, but it was not a good story. It was boring. It was a boring story. So again, I felt like we were hitting a brick wall. And then what happened was, we were in Las Vegas and I was interviewing this guy called Ray Hyman, who was a skeptic. And
the psychic powers.
Yeah, but he'd been brought in by the CIA. I mean, this was like literally, like, honestly, I don't want to sort of aggrandize the story too much, but I sort of was at the stage of basically somehow giving Channel 4 its money back, you know, because we were just failing and nothing we were doing was kind of broadcastable. And I felt the same way about the remote viewing story. I felt like they were boring and the story was already out there. And but then we met this guy, Ray Hyman, and he had been brought in by the CIA to assess the remote viewers in the early 90s. And it seemed pretty obvious, because he's a sort of known kind of James Randi type skeptic, that he would assess them as having no powers. And that would give the CIA the excuse to close down the unit, which is exactly what did happen. So I'm interviewing Ray Hyman, who was this really kind of sparkly-eyed, kind of sort of Woody Allen-ish sort of, you know, late middle age, sort of very thin, tiny kind of Jewish magician. And you know, he looked like a sort of imp. And so already he was kind of much nicer to be with than anybody else I'd been with. And I just said to him, when you were there, when you were inside the CIA, you know, testing these guys, did you happen to notice anything else going on? And this kind of look crossed his face. And he said, well, yeah. He said, I remember there was this general called Stubblebine who thought he could burst clouds just by pointing at them. I said, and there was another guy called Channon who thought he was like a lieutenant colonel called Channon who was like training soldiers to like fast for a month and, you know, and he couldn't remember. He just had these little sort of vague memories of Channon and Stubblebine. But by the end of the interview, we had these two names, Channon and Stubblebine. So we set off to try and find them. And this like unbelievable story, which nobody had told, kind of unfolded itself, which was, you know, that they were trying to walk through walls and they were trying to become invisible, which they adapted after a while, by the way, to just trying to find a way of not being seen. So I said, oh, camouflage. And he went, no. And and they were trying to kill goats just by staring at them. And which was kind of leap. That was like level three. Like level one was like observation, like how many chairs are in the room. Like level two is invisibility. It's like these are big leaps from level one to level two. And it just all... So it was like 2 years of real agony that took us to that one lucky break. And then I remember, actually, I was in New York and I phoned up my publisher, Jeff Klosky, who was beginning to worry, actually, that there was a big gap between them and Goats. In the end, it was a 4-year gap. Mm. And I think I've got it. And the thing actually that opened it up for me, the thing that made me think it was a book, was the realization that Jim Channon and General Stubblebine and these like other people, Glenn Wheaton and a few others, they all knew each other. And for some reason, that sort of unlocked it. I thought, okay, I can write this like a kind of soap opera, you know. And that was the moment that I thought there was a book.
And when the book came out and obviously became a film and mm-hmm. a lot of people will know the film and you've probably been asked a lot of times about what it feels like to have your book turn into a film and all these mm-hmm. sorts of things. But did you talked about feeling like you're on the brink of failure. Did you suddenly feel secure in your success or did it just create another level of anxiety right. somehow?
Well, actually, when the Menace at Goats first came out, it wasn't a success at all. Mm. And I'd be giving these talks. Them had been a success. And like I'd give a talk like in Oxford Street in London and I'd get maybe, you know, 300 people. And then when the Menace at Goats came out, I was back down to like about 25 people. People weren't interested in the story at all. And it sort of mystified me. I thought a lot about, you know, why this was like an amazing story. Why was nobody interested? And it dawned on me that nobody was interested because it was about craziness that was like a long way off. People didn't connect to it. And so for a few years, actually, after that, I gave up making these kind of stories. And instead, I started telling these sort of much smaller personal stories about irrationality in domestic situations, like, for instance, the being thrown in the lake mm-hmm. and going back to the school reunion. I thought that was... and sure enough, my audience, like when I give talks, the audiences got big again. And when the Menace at Goats and them were out, my audiences were mainly paranoid-looking men. And then when I started writing about, like, my domestic life, my audiences were, like, open, smiling women. So it was, like, so much more pleasurable. And so for a few years I did that. And my agent and publisher, neither of them liked it, thought that I was wasting my time telling stories about things that didn't matter. And I was saying, no, I think it matters. I think, you know, fights we have, you know, bad parenting, fights we have with our neighbours, these kind of bubbles of irrationality, I think they do matter. But in the end, a couple of things happened. Firstly, I really felt like I was beginning to kind of exploit my family for this stuff, for the tyranny of the deadline. You know, I'd start, and my son was getting older, you know, mm-hmm. he wasn't three anymore, he was like seven. And so I thought, I can't keep writing about, you know, it's exploitative, you know, to do this. So that's one reason why I quit. And the other reason was because, you know, my publisher kept saying to me, this is not good stuff, you know.
Did you feel that way?
Now looking back on it, I think there was four or five stories of about, like, I probably wrote about 100. And I think there were four or five stories that were kind of great. And in fact, I still do some of them at readings to this day. And I think the rest was sort of okay. For some reason, I wasn't, I was quite good friends at the time with Nick Hornby. And he would do that stuff kind of really effortlessly. And there was something not quite right about them.
Is your son old enough now that, have you ever talked to him about it, or?
Yeah, God, for ages he gave me such a hard time about them.
Really?
Yeah.
In what way? Like, he didn't like being in them, or he had a different take on the story?
Both. And didn't like being in them. And there's this one story about when he's about six or seven, ask me if there's a worse swear word than fuck. And I do this big story about how I sort of lie to him. And
I think I've heard that live.
Yeah, right. I say it's Lamoni. And then the next thing I know, he's having like kids around for sleepovers, and I hear them and they're all going, Lamoni. And that's like going to set this terrible ripple effect going. until finally at the end he comes into my office and he goes, hi. And I say, hi. And he goes, oh, cunt. He does work it out for himself. Anyway, I've had special dispensation from him to tell that story, even though he doesn't love it, because it's kind of funny in it and it works well on stage. But in general, he doesn't like it. Yeah, so I gave that up. And then in about 2009, the film came out.
What kind of effect did that have when it came out?
You know, funnily enough, it didn't really have that much impact on me at all. I mean, I'll use it like, you know, I'll use it like in emails when I'm trying to approach people for interviews. I'll say, you know, my books include The Man's Dead Guts, which was adapted into a film starring George Clooney. So that kind of opens.
You just have a cut and paste for that?
Yeah,
just like
basically. I could write that with my eyes closed.
But yeah. Do you, I was going to ask you, I mean, this is more, I think, partly in reference to the stories where you sort of had put yourself in them. I mean, a lot of your stories have yourself in them, whether it's about your family and its domestic situation. But do you feel like your reportorial persona is your everyday persona, or is a different person?
No, I think it's pretty much me. Yeah, I think so. I mean, the nice thing when I'm just writing and not doing radio or television is that when I'm interviewing somebody, I don't need to perform. I don't need to kind of, you know, I don't need to think about how I'm coming over. And that's why I much prefer writing. You know, you're much more, it's much less stressful, you're much more invisible, you're not acting. I always think journalists shouldn't be, like, if journalists want to go into television, you know, don't be presenters. You know, there's no connection between presenting and, you know, be a director or an editor. You know, that's the kind of journalistic side of it. I think it's pretty much me. I mean, I really am. Some people think that, like when I talk about my anxiety, I'm sort of, it's a shtick. But it's, I mean, I wish it was.
Well, there is this sort of, I mean, especially nowadays, there's the kind of like storyteller, you know, that's sort of like in the realm of journalism, or maybe they feel like a journalist, but the kind of person who, if you discovered they had maybe embroidered some of the story, they would say, well, yeah, it's all about telling a great story. But where do you feel like you fit on that spectrum? Because you also tell great, hilarious stories.
Yes. No, you're right. I mean, I remember, or somebody actually told me the other day about when the Mike Daisy thing happened with This American Life. Somebody said, I have no idea if this is true or not, but somebody said that at one point Ira said, what about David Sedaris? You know, where do we draw the line? No, I have no idea if I ever did say that or not, because somebody said that to me.
I mean, some people have written about his stories and sort of tried to figure out which parts were true and not. I don't know that he's ever responded to that or talked about it.
And also, does it matter?
Yeah.
People, in the end, who decides? I mean, this is kind of interesting, right? I mean, and this is actually what I'm going to be, what my next book's about. It's like, who decides who gets publicly shamed? And how do some people survive? And how are some people destroyed? And, you know, it feels like, at the moment, it feels like a very kind of fluid situation. You know, I can't help thinking, and really I could be wrong about this, so don't kill me if I'm wrong about this, but I can't help thinking that Joan Allera's crimes, like 15 years ago, wouldn't have been the death penalty that it turned out to be. Although it may not be a death penalty with Joan Allera, because he does have a new...
Because he's writing a book
He's got a new book deal now, but, I mean, you know, how it does is a whole different question. But my answer is that, no, I've never done anything wrong. I've never done anything that would get me into any kind of trouble. Partly because I'm incredibly neurotic and anxious, and it would just haunt me. You know, if I thought there was like something in one of my stories that could
someone could catch,
that could blow up. Yeah, it would just fucking kill me. So that's one reason. And also because, you know, the older you get, that when you're younger, an uncomfortable truth, a truth that doesn't make your story better, you sort of think, wouldn't it be better if that truth was actually that truth? You know, which is what failed Joan Allera.
Yeah, if it was just a little bit better, it would fit a little bit better, and I'd have a better story, and my editors would like it more. And
yeah, exactly. That's what killed him. That, I think, that real busyness. You know, he was like, say, he was getting all these kind of unbelievably lucrative public speaking talks, and you know, he was like way too ambitious, and you know, didn't have the time to be responsible, and became very sloppy, and then became really deceptive as well when, you know, it began to become obvious that this was what was going on. So like everything he did was wrong. But you know, the older you get, I kind of thinking that Joan Allera would have carried on doing that, because the older you get, you actually realise that no uncomfortable fact, piece of truth, makes your story worse. It's like contradictions are great. You know, what's bad is what's like the worst, for me, the worst journalistic sin in the world is kind of ridiculous polemicism. Mm. You know, it's like I don't get why all the polemicists are fine. Everybody fucking loves Jermaine Greer and, you know, Foucault and, you know, all of that crowd. To me, the contradictions, the story not turning out the way you want it to be, it's like, you know, be a kind of twig in the tidal wave of the story. There's a moment in The Psychopath Test, which, you know, which I think is the best, you know, the best thing I ever wrote. I mean, I think The Psychopath Test is the best thing I ever wrote, because mm-hmm. it's like totally, I'm like, you know, I'm going down one road where I'm like absolutely convinced that psychopaths secretly rule the world, and I am now like an unbelievably powerful psychopath spotter, and I can spot psychopaths.
So you took a course.
I took a course, yeah. I have a certificate for sentence. And I got so drunk with my psychopath spotting powers. And then about halfway through, it was actually my friend Adam Curtis, who's doing a show in New York at the moment at the Armory. He's a great, great documentary maker. And he said to me, look, don't become one of those people. And he said, you know, these things don't exist. You know, he you know, he's like kind of R.D. Lang-ish. He's like, I mean, he says, you know, obsessive compulsive disorder, you know, is that's not, you know. So, you know, there's a problem there. But I really needed Adam to say this stuff to me. I really needed him to like absolutely pour, you know, everything, you know, this entire kind of bucket of like, you know, liquid that was given my book, you know, I needed Adam to just kick it over.
Mm-hmm.
And so the book becomes, you know, I start to question everything. And that wrench where I kind of go from being this kind of, you know, confident psychopath spotter to questioning the kind of whole nature of checklists and labels and
diagnosis.
Yeah, diagnosis.
Mental illness.
Yeah, so I in the book takes like a kind of 180 degree kind of turn, which is very kind of wrenching, and it took me like a good year to make that transition, because I literally had to like pull one very solid belief system out of my head and supplant it with another one. But yeah, looking back now, I mean, God, if I'd been like so in love with the first half of the book that I was like refusing to accept the second half, you know, at best just putting under the carpet facts that didn't suit my thesis, and at worst manipulating facts, the book wouldn't have been anywhere near as good, you know. So people who do that actually, you know, are wrong.
It's boring, or it could be boring.
Yeah, it's boring. Also, you're closing yourself off to like great narrative possibilities. You know, you should have the rug pulled from under you. You should be like willing to be a twig in the tide of web. There should be no reason why you would want to manipulate a fact as a journalist. There should be no reason for it, because when things fuck up, when you can't get the interview you want, when it turns out that something you thought was true wasn't true, you know, all these things that would freak some journalists out shouldn't. You know, these are great. These should be great gifts. But I don't want to sound like fucking Tony Robbins here, like, you know. But they should be. You know, I mean, like, if the person you like desperately need to interview to get this book finished turns you down, you should think of it as like a fantastic opportunity to do something that you hadn't thought of, to go down a different road. So yeah, that's the other reason why I would never end up doing a Jonah Lehrer, because I actually think it makes the story, not only is it wrong, but it's worse for the story.
But to an outsider, you also seem like you're like the hardest working man in journalism. You're doing radio documentaries. You've got like an online series of documentaries about technology and life on the web and things like that. And then you're doing GQ stories, and then you're doing Guardian column, and then you're doing this. I mean, are you incredibly busy?
Yeah, I'm really. Yes, I am. I mean, just today I did, like, for the first couple of hours I was transcribing tapes for this big Guardian story that I'm doing. And then I was doing the voiceover for my Malcolm Gladwell film. And then I had a big session with This American Life, so I've got This American Life going out this weekend. I think now that my son's like 15 and kind of doesn't need or want me around anymore, and I've been married to my wife for like 25 years, and it's like, you know, what have I got? I should be working. It's like, also, I live in a country now, you know, where when my friends come over from London to visit, it's really nice, but it does mean that there's quite long periods when actually all my friends are in Britain and I'm in New York. So actually, you know, I feel a bit like a sort of exiled monk where all I can do is work.
Do your friends in London imagine that you're sort of like spending time with George Clooney and just
no,
living
all I do is moan to them all the time. I actually think my life is worse than it actually is. I work and then we watch an hour of TV. I go to the gym and we watch an hour of TV and go to bed. I'm bed by 10:30. And then I get up at 6 and do it all over again. But to me, it's great. I mean, like last week I was off in the Mojave Desert doing this thing for The Guardian, and that was like 4 o'clock in the morning. I was in the Mojave Desert. And for me, you know, I mean, nothing makes me as happy as that. Especially now that my son's got older, and, you know, nothing makes me happier than that, than being in an adventure. I did this thing for my next book. I shouldn't say what it is, because it is a bit of a scoop, but I basically did something for my next book that nobody else has managed to do. And, you know, you just feel like, you know, just totally blessed. And that sort of brings, you know, it's like the reason for me to sort of, you know, be alive, is to go off and have these adventures.
When is the book? When is that book coming out?
I've still got a long way to go. I'm hoping to deliver it next spring, hoping to. So it'll come out possibly next autumn. But before that, I've got this Michael Fassbender film that I wrote, Frank. Right.
What's this is American Life story? Because this will be out. That'll be out, I think, by the time air this.
I think it's a nice story. It's about a bank robbery where, I won't give you the twists in case people want to hear it. So I'll just tell you kind of the setup. The setup is is a bank robbery where the robber is like terrible. He's just like the world's worst bank robber. It's like he goes in, says this is a robbery, looks panicky, and just runs out and doesn't manage to like successfully rob any bank. And then he's caught. His entire spree lasts 4 days. And then he's caught. And it turns out that this whole thing was happening. That's completely unexpected.
Okay, that's good. That's good.
Yeah.
I think that's a really good setup. So the last question I want to ask you is, since I've told people around the office that I was going to interview you, people, they know your work and they love your work. Oh, John Ronson, you know, I love this and I love that. Do you, at this point in your career, have a sense that there is like a fan base in some sense that you're writing to or you're trying to provide something for? Or does it still feel like it did when you were, you know, younger and just sort of like doing the stories that you thought were interesting to yourself?
No, definitely. I mean, particularly in Britain, the psychopath test sold really well in Britain. When I give talks in Britain now, you know, I get good audiences of like 400 or 500 people, sometimes like 1,000 people. And so you meet them afterwards, so you get a real sense of who likes me. And you know what? I've really noticed this, and I've just really noticed this, that most of the people who like me are working class or lower middle class. I don't have much of a fancy readership. And I don't quite know why that is. I mean, it makes me sort of pleased. So for instance, I've got two speakers agents. One sort of specializes in like kind of art centers and, you know, small literary festivals. And the other one specializes in sort of business conferences and, you know, hedge funds. And she has never got me a single one.
Oh, really?
Yeah, not
never
one.
The big corporate conference?
Never. Whereas the art center, you know, I can turn up in like Doncaster or, you know, and, you know, sell out the art center there. Frankly, you know, that It's all I want and need, you know, to turn up at a sort of low middle class town, like the sort of town where I grew up, and talk to like 200 or 300 people at the art centre. That's, you know, that sort of, in terms of like what I do after I've told, you know, after I've written the story, the way, you know, that's kind of definitely enough for me. So I'm also very aware of the fact that my last book, you know, was good and people liked it. And if my next one isn't so good, you know, I'll be turning up at art centres in Doncaster and there'll be like 40 people there. So, you know, I know that it can go just as easily as it comes.
Well, thank you very much for doing this.
Thanks.
It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Longform Podcast this week. I'm Evan Ratliff from The Atavist. Quick plug, we have a story out called The Bones of Mariana by David Kushner. It's a fantastic story. It's an investigative report and a great narrative. So you can find it at atavist.com. Thanks to my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer from Longform. Thanks to John Ronson for coming in and joining me and making me laugh. And thanks to Lauren Kirchner, our editor, who, as always, makes us sound better. And we also got help from Gavin Jenkins this week. Thanks to our sponsors, EA Sports, FIFA 14, LearnVest, and Tiny Letter. And we will see you next week.